This is CliffCentral.com. Cliff Central cameos on CliffCentral.com.
Hello, 2016. And I'm Carmony, and this is CliffCentral.com. Now look, guys, I'm really excited that we have a new year. It's an opportunity for all of us to make resolutions that you can actually keep, because this is the leap year, and we need to make this count. Now, something that happened to me over December is I got in touch with an old family friend. And to me, it sounded like this guy has been depressed for the last 5 years. It was sort of like lost a job, lost a dad, and now he's doing this downward spiral. And it made me feel really helpless, I have to admit, because I didn't know what the signs were. I don't know how to give him help. I just know that there's a cry for help. And I talked to a couple of friends about it, and it seems as though I'm not the only one that's got people in my life that are facing this problem, and we're all just kind of tiptoeing around them, not really knowing how to react. So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to talk about depression as a whole, and hopefully we'll be able to put depression as or mental health on our New Year's resolution list for 2016. So in studio with me today, I have got psychologist Anitha Patha. And yes, she's also my mom. And while she's not being my mom, she's also a psychologist. So hi, mom.
Hi there.
So look, I think one of the issues that I found was that I didn't know what the clinical definition of depression actually is. Do you want to shed some light on that?
Well, I mean, if you look at the name itself, it's depressed, and it's generally depressed around emotions. It impacts on your thinking process. It impacts on you physically. And there is a gradual, sometimes there's a gradual progression into depression. It could start with dysthymia, which is depressed, low feelings, but still functional in your daily life with your work, studies, relationship, and gentle living processes. Whereas severe major depression comes up with very specific signs that impact on all those aspects of your life. It often relates to changes in your eating patterns, your sleeping patterns, your sexual desire, your physical, your psychomotor daily kind of activities, where you find that you're more tired more often, you're slower in terms of being able to move around and engage. It impacts on concentration.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I feel as though after a big night out, I have felt all of those things. Mm-hmm. I have felt lethargic. I felt as though the world is just too much. Mm-hmm. So what happens when you might feel some of these symptoms? You know, you can't engage with people. You know, you just feel like maybe cutting your hair or taking a shower on the regular might be asking too much. Sort of, when is that point when you sort of stop and you say, this is probably depressed?
Well, those feelings, I mean, often we have those feelings, but they kind of pass very quickly. Whereas the symptoms I've explained have to be in existence for at least 2 weeks. And it continues being a part of who you become and how you present yourself. Mm-hmm. So there is a basic period after which we can diagnose someone as depressed or going into the process of depression.
Mm-hmm. Well, would you say that depression is more a psychological or a chemical sort of imbalance?
Well, it's a chemical imbalance. When you feel down and the changes are lasting, your body normally manufactures chemicals, serotonin, that controls and manages happy feelings. Mm-hmm. And after a prolonged period, the body actually reduces and slowly stops producing these chemicals. And that's when medication comes into play. It becomes an important part of regaining your stability and your mental health and your emotional health.
Well, to me, it sounds like it moves from one into the other. Like it's a psychological repetitive downfall, mm-hmm, that then affects your body in such a way that your body stops functioning in its natural sort of state.
Exactly. It impacts very largely. It starts to impact on your emotional state first. Mm-hmm. And then that impacts on your cognitive, your thinking capacity, and then on your physical, somatic capacity.
I'm still sort of intrigued about when. So obviously you start feeling upset, and you start feeling upset quite often, and then it reaches the chemical phase. But your moods are adaptive. So you wake up this morning and you think, I don't want to take a shower. And then that happens a few more times. But then maybe you'll take a shower on the 6th or 7th or whatever sort of day. Mm-hmm. When is that point when you sort of think... Because obviously people now use the word, I'm so depressed. The Sharks lost this weekend. Or someone will say, I'm so depressed, I want to jump off a building. So where's that middle ground? And, where's that point where you say to someone, this is not okay?
Down feelings are not depression. Mm-hmm. I think people misuse the word because it's associated with down feelings. If you look at grief, when someone dies, it's normal to be sad. Mm-hmm. And there's normal grieving. But when it exceeds the normal bereavement period, then you start to question, has this loss triggered off a depression? Different emotional responses have very specific time frames.
Mm-hmm.
It's like postnatal depression as well, triggered off sometimes by hormonal changes. Once you've had a baby, you have lots of estrogens within circulating in your body. But also depression can be masked or other medical conditions mask depression. It's like poor thyroid functioning,
mm-hmm.
HIV, multiple sclerosis. These all impact on your hormonal production or your chemical production. So I think when you deciding on whether it's depression or whether it's a consequence of another condition and a medical condition, you need to have this assessed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think people use the word "I'm depressed" lightly to just describe
I'm
really
so depressed,
a low feeling.
I didn't have shoes in my size. It becomes a little bit silly, but I'm glad that you touched on the difference between grief and depression, because I also know that depression and anxiety are quite linked as well.
Yes.
So I don't know, people walk around and we've now got social media, we've got social pressures. I know us who are in the entertainment industry, it's the fluctuations, the ebbs and flows. And we're going to be chatting to Donovan Goliath, who's a comedian in Johannesburg and South Africa in a bit. Because, I mean, with the death of Robin Williams, it's highlighted a whole sort of band of people, mostly comics, who you think are the funny guys, when in actual fact, they're all dying inside. They're kind of crusty and gnarled and... Like, is that linked to anxiety, do you think? Because, I mean, they've got a very high-performance kind of job.
Well, often comics hold a lot of anxiety. And that becomes really the creative spirit with which allows them to do their job. And so it's a defense against the anxious feelings that make them present the world as a very happy, funny place.
Mm-hmm.
And so that it often starts at that level. They say the class clown is really often an anxious child. Anxiety is the beginning of a way to make the world look better,
mm-hmm.
By making it funny, by making it nicer, by making other people laugh.
Well, I'll be interested to see what Donovan has to say about this. But we've just got a message on WeChat from Sbeko. And he says, it's come to the point that I am depressed when I'm not on drugs. And when I get my fix, I am then depressed after my high. Now, Sbeko, I don't know what drugs you're necessarily talking about, if these are prescription or other. So maybe hit us up with another message and let us know. We'll be happy to chat about that. So look, we're going to get Donovan on the phone, but before that, let's get a bit of a music break.
CliffCentral.com. At Sibanye Gold, we believe leaders are made, not born. We also believe we can create a sustainable legacy by helping to develop tomorrow's leaders today. Which is why we have partnered with the Leadership Platform to nurture leaders who are committed to growing our country's economy. We are proud to say it's an initiative that's already showing glittering results. Sibanye Gold, we are one.
I've got fire for a heart. I'm not scared of the dark. You've never seen it look so easy.
I got a river for a soul, and baby, you're a boat. Baby, you're my only reason.
This is CliffCentral.com.
Cliff Central cameos on CliffCentral.com.
And in a rather fitting sort of array of music, that was Drag Me Down by One Direction. So we're back and we're still talking about depression here, and we've got Donovan Goliath on the telephone. Is Donovan?
Hello.
Hey, Don.
Hi, what's up?
Good, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Can't complain. I'm in PE and I'm on the beach. That's great.
Look at you, living your best life. So, Don, we've got our psychologist in studio today, Anita. Anita, Don.
Hi, Don.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. I wish I was on the beach with you.
That's pretty amazing, I'm not going to lie. But it's PE, so yeah, there's nothing else here.
Look, anyway, we're going to drag you back from the beach and take you into our topic today, which is
okay,
depression.
Cool.
And yes, my research tells me that people like Stephen Fry, Conan O'Brien, Ellen DeGeneres, Louis C.K., Sarah Silverman, I mean, there's a whole list of comedians that have all, you know, reported being depressed at some point or other. And what I wanted to know from you is, why do you think that is? Like, what happens in comedy, and why is it so difficult, and why does it have this negative effect on the people that we need to make us laugh?
You know, I mean, I'll use myself as an example. I went through a state of depression last year as well, and I couldn't figure out what it was, but I think it's more than just comedians. I think it's people who are ultra creative at times. Your brain never stops working, you know, and you're constantly trying to create stuff, you know, just not to impress people, but to impress yourself, just to get stuff out of you. So there's this constant thing inside of you to want to create and put out to the world all the time. And I think with comics especially, you know, we never stop working. We walk around, we see things, we hear things, and there's this constant processing action that's happening in our head. And a lot of times we can never solve these things to turn them into jokes. You know, you'd have a good run for about a month with the stuff that you're talking about, and then all of a sudden you dip, and you know, the stuff you're talking about isn't as funny. Somebody else is doing a lot better than you. You start to second guess yourself. You start to do stuff that you think people are going to like, as opposed to you know, what you believe in and what you think is funny. So you end up having like a lot of internal battles with yourself. You create these alter egos just to try and remain sane on stage, even though you're burning on the inside. Which happens to a lot of guys. And I think that pressure of knowing that you are the guy responsible, guy or girl, responsible for cheering people up and being the clown or jester, so to speak, you know, you never put out your true emotions. You know, you never tell people, because you're a comedian, you'll never tell people that you're actually feeling crappy or you're feeling down or you're feeling hurt, because that's not what you're supposed to do. And I think bottling those feelings in and putting this mask on just pulls you down even deeper and just forces you into this really dark and morbid place, you know, because you can never really express the dark side, because that's not who you are.
Sure. And I also think with a lot of comics, it starts when you're quite young. Because would you say that you were the class clown making people laugh from a young age?
You know what? I've always loved the attention. I've never really wanted to be a stand-up comedian. It hit me like 4 years ago when I got into comedy. But I've always loved the attention and impersonating people and, you know, dancing. And my parents told me to dance because I just loved that immediate feedback. So it was a natural progression for me, because I'm a creative person, an all-round creative person, and this is just one of the mediums that I use to express myself. But I find myself getting slightly frustrated. I control it now, you know, because I understood what has happened to me. You know, it's a result of many things. It's burnout, fatigue, just general frustration. You know, you know that you should be at a certain place at a certain time, but you're not there yet. So you try and work twice as hard, which is bad for you physically and mentally.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, all these things just add up and just put you in that dark corner, and so hard to come out of it.
Jonathan, there's no doubt, Donovan, sorry, my apologies.
Yes.
There's no doubt that the question is, where does it start? Is it that the kind of person you are and the need to please and make people laugh that determines the kind of job you go into, and that adds that kind of pressure? or is it that it begins once you start the job? And often you find that if you look back on your, you know, on your own growing up, I wonder whether you were a shy, quiet, withdrawn child before you became the funny man.
I was, actually. I was a very left-field child. Mm-hmm. I was into very, very strange things, always on my own, doing my own little things on the side, learning and just taking in. But, you know, you raise a very good point there, because I find that with a lot of young comics, I mean, myself included, when you get into it for the first time, you're doing it for fun. There's no real pressure. You're just putting stuff out there. You're having fun while writing. You're having fun jumping on stage. And even if your stuff doesn't work and people don't receive it, you kind of just brush it off and laugh it off. Mm-hmm. I think it's once the pressures of society and business and strategy and social media and all of those things come to play and people are expecting a certain thing from you, that's when you start overthinking and you lose that sort of childlike imagination of just creating for the fun of it, because creativity pretty much just comes from having fun at what you're doing. It's not a
spontaneity. Sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we lose that spontaneity and you know, you can never figure out how to get it back, because there's no real formula for it. Everybody's so different. Once, like I say, you know, all these pressures kick in and you become a business. I mean, look at Dave Chappelle is a really good example of this. Dave Chappelle created the Chappelle Show, which is still, to this day, one of the most successful comedy shows Comedy Central has ever produced. And he created season one, and everything was cool, and it was just an idea. They bought into it. They worked hard to get it out. And they offered him, you know, something ridiculous, like $20 million or whatever, to do season two, and he just walked away from it. And they couldn't understand why. They were like, yeah, but Dave, it's $20 million. Why would you walk away from this? And he literally disappeared. That's when he came and lived in South Africa for a while. He was milling around Durban. People thought he was on drugs. And in an interview with Oprah, he actually explained that, you know, you can't just force me to recreate the Chappelle Show. The Chappelle Show came out of something. We never intended it to be, you know, a seasonal thing. It was one idea. But now you're offering me $20 million, which means that you're expecting a $20 million idea, which my brain doesn't think $20 million ideas, because you've taken the fun aspect out of it. You know what I mean? And that's such a good way to kind of, I think, illustrate or demonstrate exactly what we're speaking about now, that once you put money on the table and there's a business transaction and an expectation from the other side, and you know that you're going to be filtered, then or work towards a template, then, you know, you take the fun element out, and then it just all starts going haywire. Some people can handle it, but I think the true artists, you know, the real creative people who live for the laughs, and, you know, who are more than just the business aspect of it, that one really gets to them, you know. And you named a couple, comedy named a couple of examples early on. All those guys are, you know, they're just so entrenched in their art and what they do that the moment you disrupt it, it's just, you shake their world and they can't come out of it.
Do you think it's so much about, or more about, or less about disrupting it, but also saying that you've had this moment of brilliance, and it is then about this performance anxiety related, or maybe, I mean, we were talking about this earlier, the link between anxiety and then full-blown depression. And I think when you're on stage and you have to perform, and much like Dave Chappelle, I mean, you've done this amazing thing. Musicians do it. Actors do it. You know, producers.
A lot of creatives, actually.
Exactly, all the creatives. Because it's I've heard that creativity, there's nothing truly unique about creativity. You rehash things that you've seen. But there are moments that are truly brilliant. And then to try and orchestrate that again, because usually those brilliant moments just come about quite naturally and organically.
That's true.
Then to have to, I don't know, get to a point where you've got to squeeze them all together and make this amazing $20 million moment happen again, that's anxiety provoking for me sitting here right now.
Oh, no, of course. I mean, I would freak out if somebody had to say that to me, you know, like, yo, listen, you need to create that. Like, now it's season two, it needs to be better. I just wouldn't know what to do. And I just, that's why I could never understand how Trevor was able to take on that job as Daily Show host. It's actually ridiculous. It's mind blowing. You know, it's fascinating how he just took it on and you know, no stumbling blocks in the beginning. He just went straight in and did it. I would have a heart attack. I mean, it's It's insane because it's so not necessarily out of his scope, but I mean, he is out of his comfort zone heavily, being in a different, you know, coming from a different country, and it being such a strong politically slanted show. It's fascinating, you know, how he was able to transition and just go, boom, this is it. I'm taking over. But madness.
I agree with you. Not just was it a political scope, he's filling huge shoes. He's now got an international audience. And I think social media adds such a huge amount of pressure to anyone in the entertainment industry because, you know...
But I think one of the things you forget that to become a creative or a stand-up comedian, there is a spontaneity. When you overthink things, you lose that spontaneity.
Exactly.
And what Trevor Noah seems to still have is to be able to use that moment because there is a trust in himself and his capacity.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and I suppose that's what helps you stop going into this almost this whirlwind that swallows you by the pressure of what is expected.
Yes.
And there needs to be a degree of health and a degree of self-trust in it to be able to go forward.
I was going to ask, what are some of the coping mechanisms? If you're in the shoes of Trevor Noah or, you know, Dave Chappelle, what are the little things you can do? Because, Don, we were talking about earlier how it can move from a psychological sort of depression into a chemical depression. And I'm sure that there are ways to stop that before it leads to a complete body dysfunction.
Yeah, I mean, look, for me, I'm trying my best to try and stay mentally and physically fit because that obviously takes quite a toll. I mean, especially as comedians, the lifestyles we lead, you really have to step away and, you know, run, for example, and start seeing the world in its natural state. I think we get so engulfed in watching, you know, a lot of comedy, watching too many comedy shows, seeing other people being successful, that's when you start to cloud your mind a little bit. But for me, I paint. For example, that's what I've always painted my whole life. So I try and paint as much as I can. I write. I'm a designer as well. And, you know, I've never really been into fitness and eating well, but I've realized how important it is for me right now because of, you know, all the stress I put my body under. But I have to do something still creative, but completely different to writing jokes. And I find that when I do that, it puts my mind in a state of flow where I'm not overthinking and, you know, I'm just completely relaxed, completely calm, and thoughts just jump out at me. I have thousands of notes on my phone of potential one-liner jokes, and I never really complete them. And, you know, if I'm busy painting and an idea pops up, it's normally a solution to a gag that I wrote 2 years ago that I could never find. But it's also just chatting to people, you know, like it's a very strange thing. Like you can never sit down and write comedy. You've got to spend a lot of time out there just being a normal human being and living.
Exactly.
You know, that's the hard part. You know, everybody thinks that we lock ourselves up in a room and write for days, but it's about the experiences out there and understanding because you're speaking to these people at the end of the day. So that engagement is so important. You have to walk away a lot of times. So everybody has their own mechanism, obviously. But mine is still in the creative process. I paint. I do oil paintings, and that's my thing.
It sounds brilliant. I think what you're sort of saying is that people need to take a break from the hamster wheel, because I think that's what happens. As a creative, you get this thought, and then the thought leads off, and then it's the spider diagram of your life, and you don't really know where you started unless you take a step back. So
yeah, that's true, and I mean it's a big fight that I'm having with myself right now. I read a book by a guy called Austin Kleon called "Steal Like an Artist," which is a brilliant book about you know, he touches on the fact that creatives are always put under so much pressure, especially now with social media. We put under so much pressure. We see successful people and all these artists and musicians and whatever else coming up so fast, and you're trying to be like them and get there as quick as they got there. And he says, what we always forget is that any successful person, you know, nothing is original. You mentioned it earlier on.
Mm-hmm.
What successful people do, they're very good at looking at their heroes and the people that inspire them. They're able to understand what it is about those people that inspires them. So they're not copying these people. They're basically just emulating and taking little elements. And, you know, they've got like 10 different heroes, and they don't necessarily have to be from the same discipline. I mean, you look at guys like Michael Jackson, for example. He was inspired by certain scenes from Bugs Bunny, you know, which inspired some of his dance moves. True story. Watch Bad 25, great documentary on how he made all the songs on that album. And I think once you understand what you like and what you're about, and you're able to translate that into one specific style, which is all you, then it's just free-flowing, you know? Otherwise, we're just constantly grasping, trying to find out who we are, what we do, what is our style. In comedy terms, is what is the voice? You know, the mm-hmm. voice is what comedians all speak about. And until people can kind of emulate a joke of yours on stage or mimic your voice, like, you know, we can all mimic a Jerry Seinfeld, a Kevin Hart, a Bill Cosby, because they speak the same way. They have the exact same tone, the exact same structure every single time. Unless you do that, then you still, or unless you're able to do that, you haven't found your voice yet. So much pressure.
And yet, I want to say that you can find your own. You don't have to emulate and imitate somebody else.
Well, that's true.
You can be
that's
funny
true.
Just being Donovan.
Look, I figured that's true. Don't you think there's a process, though? You imitate others and then you find your voice through that. But as you were talking, what I was thinking is that you've kind of got to decrease the clutter. And as we've been growing up, the social media that we touched on earlier, because you're not just following your heroes, you're following people, you know, your frenemies from high school, and you're going, oh, she had like a much better New Year's Eve party than me. You know, she's looking better than me. She's got kids, you know, all those sorts of things. And it ends up being this constant comparison instead of cutting down the clutter and being able to free your mind so that
just doing you.
Yeah, and just being more conscious of that.
But also about being balanced. Life is not all about work. You look at a corporate executive. If he's all about work, he's really quite a dull boy. And if you look at creatives as well, you get your creativity from engaging with the world in a balanced way.
That's
exercising
exactly
and getting rid of the excess energy that gets trapped within you. Just watching the sunrise as a moment to relax. And it's about
so
the
true.
Little things that are the big things in life.
So true.
I think the difference between entertainers or creatives and people who have a 9-to-5 is that after they leave at 5 o'clock, they leave their job, you know, wherever they
yeah.
lie.
Yeah.
With us, I think it follows you everywhere you go.
Yeah, you never sleep, man. It's just constantly rolling. I do that. I get up. I mean, I have two notebooks next to my bed, one for comedy and one for any other ideas I think of. And I write in those regularly. I just wake up in the middle of the night, oh my God, idea. You know, get up to go and pee at 3 a.m. and then you get the thought while you're peeing. And then you got to write it down and that'll keep you up for the next hour.
Okay, well, look, Don, I'm going to say enjoy the beach and maybe
Thank
try
you.
Not to drink the water before bed.
Yes, probably not.
Catch you later, man. Bye.
Cool, man. Thanks for the chat. Bye.
This is CliffCentral.com. Clip Central cameos on CliffCentral.com.
And that was Trouble to Me by Iggy Azalea and Jennifer Hudson. Now, if you want to get hold of us, we're at CliffCentral.com. And maybe if you have any questions, the number is 0861-555-189. Or catch us on Twitter at CliffCentral.com or Facebook at CliffCentral or on WeChat. Because we've just got a response from Speko, who messaged in earlier to say that when he's not on drugs, or he feels depressed, and then when he's not on drugs, then he needs a fix, and then he's depressed after the high. So I asked Speko to let me know if these were prescription or, you know, anything else, and he's messaged back to say, well, just for fun, I smoke weed, but when I go hard, meth and cat. I really feel depressed when I'm sobering up. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, certainly if he's depressed without the without his substance use, it means that he is struggling with depression and that he's self-medicating. This is his way of reducing the depressive symptoms. And that is dangerous because you are your own doctor and you don't know anything about it. You don't know the quantity or whatever in which to make you feel better. You're needing to go and see a professional who can help with the depression, because the drug usage is as a result of the depression.
Well, I mean, this all sounds quite expensive. What if people can't afford to go and see a fancy psychologist or, you know, get that sort of level of help?
There's certainly state facilities that will help. A psychiatric unit at any hospital, state hospital, will be able to help him with that. We have psychiatrists and psychologists at state-provided hospitals.
Mm-hmm. And what about the medication with that? Because, okay, fine, you can go and you can get the treatment for free, but aren't the medications quite costly thereafter?
No, it is provided by the state as well. So the complete service is offered there. So it's important to be able to take it, because trying to self-medicate depression yourself just exacerbates the conditions. It could get worse. You could start having hallucinations and withdraw on your withdrawals of your meds. So it actually worsens it. So it's important to deal with it right now.
Okay, well, that's good advice, Speko. Let us know if you need, details of a state hospital that we can put you in touch with. But, I mean, this goes back to a sort of prescriptive drugs of depression. How do antidepressants work? Because you said that it's a serotonin level sort of change or depletion.
Yes. Basically, the body naturally, in a healthy state, produces chemicals within it that help keep our psychological, emotional, physical balance. When we in particularly affective states that make us feel down, depressed, dysfunctional, poorly functional, over a prolonged period of time, what our body naturally produces starts to reduce. And eventually, if the symptoms are not dealt with, they stop producing that. So medication actually replaces the chemicals that your body naturally manufactures. So that's the purpose of medication. And as you deal with the issues that lead you to your depression, eventually with time you can actually reduce the medication and wean yourself off it. But therapy and medication go side by side.
Sure. I was just going to say, surely with the medication, you've got to have a psychological, like working out what's going on with you psychologically, not just chemically. But I know that the worst possible outcome of depression has been suicide. We've seen Robin Williams, and yes, you know, a lot of the stuff I've read have said that he had some kind of pre-Alzheimer's or, you know,
Parkinson's
or whatever, you know, some kind of neurological deterioration that has led to his depression. But, you know, how do you find out when someone's at that point?
I think it's hard, because I think the person is feeling very helpless. And with the helplessness comes a helplessness if you can't actually help yourself out of the situation. And it literally is a spiraling into a sense of not being able to see your future and seeing it any better. And that's when you start with the thoughts, the ideations, the thoughts around how you could help yourself in killing yourself, really. Because it just feels that there's no other way out of this. If you look at Robin Williams, there must have been a high anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And high anxiety that's not dealt with progresses into a depressive state.
Well, what do you think about people who, or what is your comment about people that try and hurt themselves or feign suicide for that, you know, cry for help? Or what's the difference between those people and those that plan to commit suicide and actually succeed?
Well, I mean, often you find that people's cry for help, I'm not serious about it, I cut myself, but not too seriously. And this is a way of saying to the world, I'm wanting help. I want people to give me help because I can't help myself. You often find this with adolescents. It starts there.
Mm-hmm.
Adolescence, I always say, is a psychotic state. I use it as a in a very light way when I say psychotic, because you find adolescents are happy one minute and they're sad the next minute, and they're crying and they're laughing, and they go through almost the entire season in one day. And so it's the beginning of that. And often angry people start to inflict the anger on themselves. And that is the beginning of the cutting.
Mm-hmm.
And that gets progressively worse, because with it also comes changes in personality. And then you can also have a depressive personality. You can have full-blown depression. A lot of the way you handle your emotional state, or your emotional state is handled by the caregivers and parents around you, in a way determines how you go into adulthood, because it's the beginning of your personality that stays with you for the rest of your life.
Do you not think that the people or your community, or even just your sort of strata of society, allow you to feel depressed or not? Because I think depression has been seen as the disease or the ailment of the middle class, because they're allowed to feel awful or terrible about what's happening. But if someone who was from, you know, a lower socioeconomic bracket, who, you know, had to walk to get water, or who had to, you know, live a much harder life, do you think that there is depression in lower socioeconomics or lower income households as well?
There certainly is depression in low socioeconomics, but I think the daily struggle of life almost doesn't allow you to sit with these thoughts and feelings. You have to get out there and do what you have to, and it becomes a necessary part of your life. But it also feels like you often skip that depressive state and go into a more serious mental state, which is often a schizophrenic or an extreme severe mental disorder.
Mm-hmm.
With middle class people, the basics are there. And if you look at the needs of a human being, your first need is food, shelter, love. Your development of yourself and even sitting with your thoughts and feelings are higher order needs.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at middle class homes, those basic necessary needs are being met. And so that is why I think presentation of depression is more prevalent in middle class and upper and higher socioeconomic strata.
Okay. Well, I think before people get to that sort of point, if, like this family friend of ours who I've been concerned about this holiday, what are the sort of telltale signs? Because for me, he's been acting out. He's been very aloof. I've had conversations with his mom, and he hasn't been taking care of himself physically. He hasn't been able to hold on a job. He avoids people and contact for the most part of it. I mean, those are some of the signs. What if you see all of those things, how do you help that person?
You know, you can actually help by guiding them into professional help. But a lot of that help can only be given if the person is aware enough of their own condition and is willing to help. We can offer you medication. If you don't take the medication, there's nothing any professional or any outside help can offer you.
Mm-hmm.
I always say to patients, we only do half the work. The other half you do on your own.
Mm-hmm.
I think in real serious conditions where people's lives are at risk, their lives or other people's lives by them, it is possible to commit. The state can take responsibility to commit the person into a psychiatric facility where they are forced to get help.
But this sounds like a sort of a last resort. That person has to now hurt themselves or hurt someone else, or, you know, do something incredibly drastic. I just kind of wish that there are other ways to get that person to realize where they're at. But it feels like in this specific case, that person has to go above and beyond.
Mm-hmm. Certainly when friends and family are able to recognize that the person is feeling down, especially when it's not reached a point where that person can't see it. It's early in the depressive phase that the greatest help can be given, when the person can think rationally, because often in seriously depressed situations, your rational capacity gets lost as well.
I have to agree with you. So look, I think what we can get out of this today is you need to feel centered, you need to feel yourself and be able to give yourself a break from your daily life for mental health. And that's what we've been talking about today. Duncan saying to me, we must not be so hard on ourselves, because I think that we get into this rut, and it's that hamster wheel we were talking to Donovan about, where you want to get better, you want to be better than yourself and achieve all these goals. And I think at the end of the day, we end up putting so much pressure on ourselves that I think it's anxiety, and hopefully it will never get to full-blown depression like what we've been talking about today. So my outro is, just take care of yourself and your mental health for 2016, because that's the thing that's going to drive you forward and make you achieve those goals. So if you want to catch me on any of the social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, I'm at Carmony Patha. And that's me out for Cliff Central.
This is CliffCentral.com.